with a compelling perspective on global politics. This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. All right, welcome to the program. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We're live and direct for the next 2 hours. We're going to be joined by a couple of incredible guests over the next 2 hours. In the first hour, we're going to be joined by TNT's political editor, Basil Valentine, for a look at the world headlines and some global game changers. I'm looking forward to that conversation. And also in the first hour, those of you who have been living on the moon might have missed the fact that there's been a historic rally on both gold and Bitcoin in the last couple of weeks. It's really unbelievable what's happening in the markets. And it's more incredible how many people don't even want to talk about it. But those of you who are independent investors, those of you who do care about the economy, you're going to be paying very close attention to this. We'll talk to Blake Lovewell, who's going to rejoin us after a very long hiatus. Blake has been away in like a Buddhist temple or something like that in India for like a month, and he's back on the scene. We'll talk to Blake about what's happening in the markets. Totally historic. So also in the second hour, big surprise, of course, your requests have been answered. We will have Scott Ritter on the program to talk about the state of play regarding Israel and Iran and a whole lot more. I'm looking forward to that conversation. I've been waiting for that for a very long time. Scott has penned an incredible article that's up on his Substack. We've also been able to republish that at 21st Century Wire. It's called The Missiles of April. And it is a very concise, well-constructed piece by Scott. And it really just kind of lays out where things are in this situation with this incident over the weekend and then a broader geopolitical scope. We're going to delve into some of the tough questions with Scott Ritter surrounding this historic event over the weekend. There's no other way to describe it. So I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be a very powerful conversation, no doubt. Certainly one we've been waiting a very long time for. Over in the news, before we connect with Mr. Valentine, over in the news, Tayyip Erdogan, the Turkish leader, he has basically, he's blaming Israel for the Iranian attack. So he's shouting at the top of his lungs. So, you know, good for you, Turkish leader. You're still shouting, but when it comes to actually doing things, taking action, a little bit slow to the punch, all talk, no action, all hat, no cowboy. That's the Turkish leader. A lot of people become skeptical about his commitment to the Palestinian cause that he waxes so often about. Is that just to curry favor among his base, his AKP base, conservative base in Turkey? Or does he actually mean it? Is Turkey actually going to get up and do something about the genocide which Israel's carrying out in Gaza? That's the big question. So again, a lot of hot air coming out of Ankara. Is it going to result in anything? Who knows? Maybe not. However, Iran has completely changed the book, the rule book on this in the Middle East. Of course, we're going to talk about that a lot, maybe a bit with Basil Valentine, but definitely with Scott Ritter in the second hour. And here's a great piece penned by Abbas Juma. He is a journalist and a Middle East expert. This is what he has to say, and I tend to agree with this analysis. He's saying, what has Iran accomplished over this weekend? It's important to emphasize that Iran's operation carried out more political than military weight. Interesting. It's kind of what we were talking about yesterday with Tony Gosling. In this sense, it was carried out subtly and was a success. Obviously, the Iranians did not want to start a war which would involve the United States. Neither would America, by the way, my caveat, even though that is what Netanyahu wanted. That's right. Israel wanted to draw the United States into a direct confrontation with Iran, because that serves the interest of Netanyahu and Israel. Abbas continues, obviously, the Iranians did not want to start this war. In other words, Israel didn't manage to provoke Iran in the way that it intended. It's also obvious that the Islamic Republic possesses more powerful drones and missiles than those it used in the attack on April 14th. Very important. Scott, we'll talk about that with Scott as well in the second hour. However, even the less advanced drones and missiles were able to penetrate Israeli airspace and inflict economic damage, since Israel spent much more money on shooting down these missiles and drones than Iran spent on launching them. Don't you worry, the United States will write out a blank check anyway for Israel, just more deficit spending, another $1 trillion per quarter, or whatever we're doing in terms of deficit spending in Washington. It's about $1 trillion a quarter, $4 trillion a year, give or take a trillion, who's counting, right? So he continues, Tehran has once again demonstrated that Israel is not invulnerable and it is possible to attack it. As for the degree of inflicted damage, which some commentators were unsatisfied with, it largely depends on the type of missiles and drones used in the attack, and Iran has a lot of military equipment. Finally, Iran's main achievement is that it managed to confuse Israel in the same way that it was confused after the October 7th Hamas attack. The country has to respond, but how? How should Israel strike Iranian proxy forces somewhere in the Middle East? This is possible, but Israel does it all the time without much result anyway. Should it hit Iran directly? But would that start a war, which no one is prepared for, including the U.S.? That's the main question, isn't it? If Iran is hit by Israel inside Iranian territory, the Iranians have already said point blank, if Israel tries to retaliate, we will hit them back 10 times harder than we did on April 14th over the weekend. So all those air bases, all those sort of military sites, if there's any civilian casualties inflicted in Iran by an Israeli attack, most certainly Iran's going to want to also inflict casualties on the Israeli side in retaliation. And then where will we be at that point? Is there any place where you could plausibly hit the brakes on an exchange like this as they climb up the escalation ladder? That's the big question. We're going to try to answer some of those questions as well in the second hour. So we're looking forward to that. Now, one of the big beneficiaries of this, of course, has been Russia, because now the focus of Washington is totally off Ukraine and totally on the Middle East. So we're not saying that Iran is working together with Russia in order to create this grand distraction. I think that would be presumptuous and maybe gratuitous in the extreme. However, it does look like it's kind of shaping up that way incidentally. Washington now says, panicking, John Kirby, shaking in horror, as he has to face the press with a rudderless Biden regime, doesn't know where it's going, whether it's coming or going in Ukraine or in the Middle East. And now he's having to say Washington has no intention of directly engaging Russian forces on Kiev's behalf, says the senior official. This was just over the last 24 hours. So the U.S. will not shoot down Russian drones and missiles fired at Ukraine. Zelensky's been banging his pots and pans together for more cash and more assistance from the United States. So this is in contrast to how American forces protect Israel. So Zelensky's looking at this scene right now, just over the weekend, where U.S. defense batteries in Jordan were shooting down Iranian drones and missiles as they went over the airspace of the Kingdom of Jordan towards their targets in Israel. France was also weighing in on this. U.S. boats were also doing anti-missile work from where their positions are on the water in the Middle East, tracking these projectiles from Iran and trying to shoot them down. Okay, so Zelensky's looking at this and saying, why can't you do this for me? What about me? Why can't you shoot down Russian missiles that are heading for Ukraine? And the U.S. is saying, sorry, but you know, our relationship, our friendship with you, Zelensky, is just not that deep, not like it is with Israel. So that's the reality of the situation. That's bad news, of course, for Zelensky, bad news for Kiev, and what's left of Ukraine. When I say what's left of Ukraine, I'm dead serious. The longer this ridiculous proxy war goes on, the smaller Ukraine is going to become as a country. The United States, the UK, France, all of these countries, including Jordan and some of the Gulf Arab countries, in some way, shape, or form, helped to repel the Iranian barrage, not fully successfully, but mostly, which was launched over the weekend in retaliation for Israel destroying an Iranian embassy in Damascus on April 1st. Okay, so John Kirby was asked during the daily briefing whether the United States would extend the same sort of favor or support for the Zelensky regime. And he said, no, not really. He says, I knew this question was coming, said Kirby. He said, look, different conflicts, different airspace, different threat picture. And it has been clear from the beginning, he's talking about Biden, that the U.S. will not get involved in that conflict in a combat role, says John Kirby. So there you are. So you know where the U.S. stands on this. Again, an indirect beneficiary of this. Russia is this latest round of hostilities in the Middle East, like it or not. That's how it shapes up. Let's take a short break right now with the network. When we come back, we'll connect with TNT's political editor, Basil Valentine, for headlines and more. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Stay right there.
TNT's State of the Nation.
President Xi of China absolutely has his eyes on Taiwan. He always has. And America has been a steadfast supporter of Taiwan until Stumblebum Joe hit the scene. And now President Xi says no one can stop the, quote, family reunion with Taiwan. These people really want a war, don't they?
Family reunion. Well, that's a great title for what we got going on the grand chessboard here, isn't it? Yeah, they've been telegraphing this one for a long time, and no surprises here, Timothy.
And, you know, I think that the Taiwanese might have something to say about that being a family reunion, like Ashley Biden not wanting a family reunion with Joe. Like, she doesn't want another shower with Pedo Joe. I think that's how Taiwan must feel.
State of the Nation on today's News Talk, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular, we can build that.
CO2 sustains all life on Earth, but now it's in long-term decline. We face the return of an ice age. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, folks. We're still in the first hour of this live broadcast. I want to welcome onto the program TNT's political editor, Mr. Basil Valentine's joining us right now on the live link. I see it's a USA-themed segment. So, Basil, what's happening in America right now?
Oh, Patrick, you know, you're not supposed to ask me that just because of the background. We're here to talk about the Middle East for now, because it is our solemn duty, to be honest, and the attack on the Damascus consulate, which led to the current round of hostilities, was deliberately designed to be a distraction from what's happening in Gaza. It's as simple as that. No one was killed in the Iranian attack on Israel. One 7-year-old girl was injured. Very unfortunate. But are the Israelis planning on starting World War III? On the basis of the injuries to one individual? That would seem to be the equation on the face of it. Meanwhile, in Gaza, because I'm not going to allow Netanyahu's distraction tactic to work, 8 policemen were murdered today when the car they were traveling in the north of Gaza was deliberately targeted. These are some of the people responsible for trying to maintain some sense of order amongst the nightmarish chaos of northern Gaza as people attempt to return home to the north from the abysmal conditions in the south, not that they're any better in the north. And these policemen were murdered in cold blood. These are people trying to secure food and maintain order. Meanwhile, further south, 11 children have been killed, murdered in a playground. They went out to play just a short break from the nightmare, only to find themselves deliberately targeted. At least 11 killed and dozens of others wounded. I've even seen a report on social media from our friend Khaleesi, which certainly purports to show an Israeli drone playing the sound of a child, a baby crying. And then when concerned citizens emerge from the rubble to find the child and offer it some comfort, they are shot at. Can you imagine such a thing? Using the recording of a wailing infant to draw people into the open so that you can shoot them. I can't verify that. But the horrors in Gaza continue. Yet all the oxygen in the room is taken up with the hand-wringing and wailing and gnashing of teeth about, you know, how Israel should or shouldn't respond to what was in the end a choreographed and ultimately toothless attack, gesture politics, little more than that, by the Iranians. They did not use their Fatah hypersonic missiles. They instead used a three-pronged attack, which consisted of decoys, a detached warhead with a booster on it, and then a mid-range old ballistic missile coming in behind the first two. The Israelis themselves, as well as Britain and America, were told 72 hours in advance what was going to happen, now so that they could be prepared and set up the necessary defences. The only caveat to that is that I have heard from a colleague here on TNT, I should add, Pelinoroth Taylor, that there is a rumour that one Israeli military base was quite badly damaged at the weekend. But that this isn't being widely reported. And this is why the Israelis are saying that Iran will not get off scot-free. I mean, really, it's come down to sort of a battle of egos, really. Who wants to have the last punch, like some playground fight or something? You know, the Israelis don't want to appear that they've been bested by Iran and that the Iranians have managed to launch an attack from Iranian soil directly onto Israeli soil without any serious comeback. All the indications are that the United States, the White House and allies want to tone down any response so that it doesn't provoke a further response. The tit for tat has to end somewhere. Otherwise, we're in World War III. It's as simple as that. One possibility I saw being mooted was that the Israelis might retaliate with a cyber attack. Well, that really is just a sort of, that's a shrug and a, you know, for all that people say cyber attacks count as acts of warfare. I mean, I think in the present situation, everybody would be mightily relieved, even delighted, if all that happened was a cyber attack. I mean, that's a nothing, you know. So everybody gets a cyber attack every day. So completely meaningless. So, but at the moment, we don't know what it'll be. You know, getting the usual cliches about Israel will choose a time and a place, you know, of its own for any reprisals. This is arguably a more dangerous moment than the one at the weekend when it was the Iranians' turn. If Israel now decides to launch a major artillery-orientated missile attack, particularly aimed at Iranian nuclear facilities, which are well dug in the ground, incidentally, they're not easy to destroy at all, then, you know, all bets are off, and so on and so forth. Of course, the White House could put an end to any further retaliation immediately. You know, if they really wanted to threaten to cut off the endless supply of military aid and equipment, as well as the diplomatic cupboards of the Israelis, they can do so. And then the Israelis are really isolated, and they wouldn't want to do anything major from an isolated position. Although, you know, strictly speaking, there wouldn't be anything to stop them. And some of the hotheads, the Smotriches of the cabinet, possibly Yoav Gallant as well, believe it or not, at the moment, Netanyahu is the steadying hand. He is the one that doesn't want to react too quickly or too hard. And Benny Gantz, who in the twisted world of Israeli politics is theoretically to the left of Netanyahu, he's the one pushing for an immediate and harder response. So, you know, is the future of the world down to the decision of this three-member Israeli war cabinet of psychopaths who, you know, seem determined to carry on murdering children and policemen in Gaza willy-nilly? Well, who knows? That's where we are at the moment.
Well, normally the Israelis will make a threat saying, we're going to respond and it's going to be overwhelming force and so forth. But the problem is they're now locked into an escalation, a new escalation ladder, which was reset by the Iranians. So the Iranians said, go ahead if you think you're going to strike us in Iran, or they said any of our assets anywhere, or properties or embassies or whatnot, anything, even in Syria, targets in Syria, they will hit back with overwhelming force again in Israel. And they said that what they showed over the weekend was just a warning shot that Iran sent. Basically, they'll come back, with 10 times more force. So presumably we're talking about hundreds of ballistic missiles. So if they targeted, and you're right, there are reports, Nevatim Air Base in the Negev Desert, but also Ramona military facility. This is where it's believed where the impact is. A lot of the videos we see of the impact of Iranian missiles, the people believe that was in the Ramona base. And these are two very key strategic bases for Iran. And these are also places where they launch attacks on Gaza, air attacks. And it's theoretically where some of their air assets, Israel's, will be deployed to attack Iran. So now, just by nature of the Israeli threat, Basil, Iran has an incentive to actually hit those bases, and they can. So now we're in a totally different escalation reality here. This is different than before the weekend, where Iran just took it on the chin. Kill the scientists, they take it on the chin. Kill the generals in Syria, take it on the chin. One after another, for the last, I don't know how many years, they've taken it on the chin. They finally hit back. Symbolically, yes, as you said, but it's a new reality. The question is, Basil, has this reality hit home in Tel Aviv and in Washington? I think the Americans understand, Basil, what's happening. I'm not sure if the Israelis do, though. We'll wait and see.
Very good question. We're in uncharted territory, as you say. I mean, what this has exposed is the egregious double standards of the West. You know, David Cameron on his high horse talking about how, you know, outrageous the Iranian response was, until Kay Burley, the only person to have actually asked a meaningful question of any major politician in Britain over the last 2 weeks, said, well, what would Britain do if our embassy was attacked? And he had to admit that we would respond very strongly. So, and then there's the sanctions question, the EU working to expand sanctions against Iran. The Iranians didn't kill anyone. The Israelis have killed 50,000 people in the last 6 months. Yet they're, you know, Baerbock, the green, Pelle also told me that in Germany, they're calling the Green Party camouflage, because there seem to be more, you know, army camouflage green, because they're bigger warmongers than any other party. She's gone to Israel to offer full support and, you know, claim that they should try and sort of wind their neck in a bit. The only European leader of any standing to say anything remotely meaningful on the subject is the new Irish Taoiseach, who said that Stephen Harris said that Israel has gone from reason to revenge. It went to revenge a long time ago, about 6 months ago. But the net effect of the weekend is that the diplomatic support for Israel, which had been ebbing away very fast up until that point, is suddenly shored up again by, you know, NATO and traditional Israeli allies, even though this response by Iran was largely theatrical in the final analysis.
So the Germans flying to Israel to support a genocidal regime, I guess there's a lot of historical form there, so we shouldn't be surprised. We are in 2024, after all, where nothing really makes sense. But I think that's pretty extraordinary. Not a very good move by Germany, considering that they're being dragged into the dock by Nicaragua in the ICJ for being complicit and accessory in Israel's genocide against the native Palestinian population in Gaza. So Germany just can't do anything right at this point. They seem to be one bad move after another. And that's your biggest economy, the most powerful country in Europe, Europe's representative, you could say, for the EU. And look at them. They're just all over the place. It's embarrassing.
Yes, less and less so, I think, with Germany. I think the days when, you know, Chancellor Kohl and then Angela Merkel sort of bestrode Europe as the unofficial chief are fading fast. I don't think people take Scholz, let alone Baerbock, anything like as seriously. I mean, I don't think the Israelis take anybody remotely seriously except the President of the United States. They don't get me wrong, they love all the adulation and the support and the, you know, people like von der Leyen wrapping herself up in the Israeli flag. They lap up all the fawning, but when it comes to any kind of pushback, it's not that there is much, it's completely ignored. The man masquerading as British Prime Minister for the time being, Rishi Sunak, has apparently called for calm heads in a call this evening with Netanyahu, stressing that significant escalation is in no one's interests and would only deepen insecurity in the Middle East. He should really have said that 6 months ago. He added he wants to see a massive step change in the amount of aid being delivered to Gaza. Yet he is still supplying Israel with weapons and munitions. So, you know,
here's an idea. That's a good idea. Why don't the Israelis just borrow Rishi Sunak, bring him to Tel Aviv, where he can pound his fist on the pulpit and say, this Iranian missile attack is completely unacceptable. Completely unacceptable. And that should do it, right? That should deter the Iranians, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, Sunak isn't going to be around for much longer. There's talk of an extremely agitated atmosphere in number 10 Downing Street with lots of rows, and Sunak himself extremely petulant. He knows he's going to be out of office within 6 months, if not sooner, and there's absolutely nothing he can do about it. We've got major local elections coming up in Britain early next month, and the Tories could be wiped out, which may prompt, believe it or not, yet another leadership contest in the Conservative Party ahead of an autumn election. So, you know, soon after.
Have they got anybody left on the bench? How deep is the Conservative bench? I mean, they've gone through how many prime ministers in the last 2 years? Who's left? Who wants the job?
Well, good question. You know, Sunak is the third, but there's always another one. You know, we are talking here about the most successful political organization in modern history, the British Conservative Party. And if they think they're going to lose a major election, they don't hesitate to decapitate the party and replace the leader with another figurehead. One that is being mooted, believe it or not, is David Cameron. Now, I'm not sure what the precedent is in the last 150 years for a prime minister to be sitting in the House of Lords. I mean, back in the day, of course, you know, Lord Palmerston in Victorian times, Lord Salisbury and others were prime ministers, but it's not really the done thing these days. So it is, believe it or not, possible, because he is accorded a degree of gravitas. And if there's anybody in the British establishment taken remotely seriously, it would be him. Can you imagine Kemi Badenoch going to Tel Aviv, for example?
I can't. I can't. They shouldn't be going to Tel Aviv full stop. I mean, it's just like, unless they're begging them to stop killing the natives. It's like, who are we going to deploy to Berlin during the Second World War to tell Hitler to hit the brakes on the camps? You know, it's like, this is where we're getting with Israel. They become such a pariah state internationally. And I think any country that's throwing their sort of undying support behind them, I think is going to be behind the eight ball in a not very distant future, Basil, because look at the Middle East. It's totally transforming now. The balance of power in Europe, Middle East, Asia is shifting radically. But you listen to these people waxing on in the House of Commons as if they're still, I don't know, what, in 1980 or something, or 1990s or something. I mean, totally delusional, just refusing totally.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally delusional. I agree. Cameron, for what it's worth, is expected to arrive in Israel overnight tonight, according to the Times of Israel, where he's going to meet Netanyahu along possibly with Benny Gantz. And he's also going to travel to Ramallah to meet senior figures from the Palestinian Authority. Worth noting that the UN is demanding Israeli forces end their support of the homicidal attacks in the West Bank, which, of course, are little reported on. A Palestinian teenager was killed there yesterday. Just another one, at least 25 others wounded. I mean, it's just absolutely relentless. At least 466 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces or settlers in the West Bank since October the 7th. Mm-hmm. Is David Cameron going to say anything about that to Netanyahu and Gantz?
I hope so. I mean, armed Israeli terrorist gangs marauding, burning homes, shooting and killing unarmed Palestinian civilians in the West Bank. That's terrorism. And this seems to be getting the support of a lot of Western governments still. I mean, Washington has censured them. They've asked for this to kind of be calmed down a bit, but instead it's just been ramped up. So clearly there is talk between Ben-Gavir and his radicals, small church, as you said. They're communicating with these people saying, hey, go for it. Now's the time. Now's the time to get that olive grove you wanted, to get that Palestinian farm you wanted in the West Bank. Go for it in the Jordan Valley. They're trying desperately to change facts on the ground while all this other stuff is going on. So we have to keep our eyes on all of it because everything is in play right now.
Yeah. Meanwhile, a small raft of European countries headed by Spain and Ireland are proposing to recognize a Palestinian state at some point in July, much to the irritation of Netanyahu. Where exactly this Palestinian state is supposed to exist remains to be seen. And finally, given that we've got the stars and stripes, House Republicans have presented Mayorkas impeachment articles to the Senate. Democrat members have argued the articles are a matter of policy dispute and not high crimes outlined in the Constitution. Do you think that one will go anywhere, Patrick?
Yeah, I think it might go somewhere. I don't think they'll get any votes outside of the Republicans on that, but certainly I think it'll just raise the issue during the election years. You know, immigration is one of the most emotive issues you can have on an election platform. So, and that's for good reason, because traditionally it just rouses up and it motivates voters. It's just one of those emotive issues. So I think this will help to energize that for the Republicans going into the final mile there of the general. This bizarre and strange, weird and twisted general election that we're seeing in 2024. Listen, Basil Valentine, thank you very much.
Before I go, I've got a comment on the TNT radio illumination to your immediate left. I can't tell if that's a projection or whether it's a physical object.
See, that's how good we are with our special effects. You can't tell if it's the real deal or not. I can tell you that is a real neon sign.
I want one of those.
I knew everybody would want one as soon as I had it. So I'll work on that. Maybe for your birthday, Basil, us something to shoot for. Basil Valentine, political editor at TNT, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Patrick.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to take a short break here with the network. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about money, finance, gold, Bitcoin rallies with Blake Lovewell, who's going to be joining us after a long hiatus in just a moment. I'm Patrick Henningsen. Stay right there.
When I had my heart event close to 4 years ago, I was at the gym, thought I deserve a coffee, and thought I'll top up with fuel, ordered a coffee. But while I was pumping fuel, I started to get chest pains. Then it got worse and worse and worse. So then I was leaning on the counter thinking, yeah, something's not quite right. So then I went to wait for the coffee, and that's when it really, really hit. And Joy just, you know, mouthed, do you need an ambulance? And I remember nodding. I wasn't even thinking about a heart attack. I just thought, something is seriously wrong with me here. So when the cardiologist came to see me, she informed me that I'd had what they call a widowmaker heart attack. Bit of a shock when someone says, you know, you nearly died. Everybody should be aware of all the symptoms of a heart attack that women can have that aren't typical of the shoulder pain, the right arm pain. I go to the gym, I do yoga, Pilates, I swim, I go on bike rides, and yet I still had a heart attack. You just don't know, it could be you.
The challenges our planet's animals are facing sometimes feel a bit heavy.
The animals haven't eaten in a day, 2 days, they haven't drank anything. They're cold, they're dehydrated.
But remember, there's good happening right now. At home.
All right, we were able to get into your unit and we have all four of your cats. So,
okay. And around the world for any animal, any disaster. Search ifa.org/disaster ready.
Political commentator and investigative journalist. You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, folks, welcome back. Welcome back. And a great segment, of course, as usual, with TNT's political editor, Basil Valentine, about the state of the world, the Middle East, British politics, and a whole lot more. But one subject that doesn't get a lot of attention and should get more is money, finance. Right now, we're looking at historic highs in terms of gold. I don't know about silver. We'll talk to Blake Lovewell about that. But also Bitcoin has just shattered all expectations in an unprecedented historic rally, all-time highs across the board. What does this usually mean? Bad news for the U.S. dollar, bad news for inflation. These are all signals that usually come. And what's coming next is a spike in oil prices, folks. And just in time, the tension in the Middle East, it's all weaving together like a perfect equation. Is it by design or is it just serendipity of the markets? Depending on what side of the markets you're on, you stand to make a killing. If you're on the consumer end and you're in the U.S. dollar, you'll be suffering a little bit, feeling the pain of all this. We'll talk about this and more with our next guest. I want to welcome back onto the stage. He's a contributor at 21stCenturyWire.com. He's a keen eye on the markets. His name is Blake Lovewell. He's joining us on the live link right now from the sunny shores of Albion. Blake, how are you?
Hey, Patrick. I'm doing really well, and it's great to be back with you here on TNT. I got so many questions to ask about all your travels, but yeah, we better give the viewers some information too about economics.
So right now, Blake, I mean, what's happened over the last month is pretty historic. I mean, usually alarm bells should be going off, but you've got all these distractions in Ukraine and the Middle East. It's taken people's attention off of these historic moves on the markets. I'm talking about gold breaking, you know, it was nearly $25 an ounce and shattering the 2000 barrier handedly in the last couple of months. And of course, Bitcoin outperforming all the skeptics. I mean, it's pretty unbelievable. Meanwhile, the dollar is hanging on for dear life. And what's going to happen with the price of oil in the next couple of months, especially with all this hostility in the Middle East, Blake? What do you think about all this? All these things converging, all of these black swans coming at once.
Exactly. Well, yeah, it's so interesting right now to keep an eye on economics. I'm a big fan of geopolitics too, and so meshing the two together, I think oil is one of the most important to look at. But still, we're in the petrodollar era, so oil is still priced in dollars, and therefore it's dependent on the, you know, value of the dollar as things go. And I think short-term oil is going to stay stable because so many people in industries depend on it. If any one of these many factors you've brought up go out of control, then you're going to see the contagion spread or the wildfire spread. What we're looking at, to bring the metaphor of wildfires, we're looking at a very dry, arid desert. There hasn't been a lot of rainfall, and you know, any dropped match or any tinder could really set off what could be a catastrophic economic collapse. Although I pray see that with, if you're looking at regular economic data, if you're just a kind of regular Joe, how do you find out a bit about the economy? Well, one thing is prices in the shop of food and goods and services. I think most people will agree on that front, that we've seen just this steady inflation, just depreciating the value of currencies. Things cost more and more over time. You kind of start smarting when you get to the till to pay for something and you think, wow, is that really what it costs now? Because my wages aren't keeping pace with the price increase. So that's a slow and steady on the ground experience. Then if you're a regular Joe who's looking at the mainstream media or reading newspapers, even reading like the Financial Times, you'll see actually the stock market doing really well. That was until, you know, the last week, but the stock market breaking all-time highs as it usually does, because the stock market benefits from the printing of money. That's where lots of the money ends up going to, because people, you know, want to manufacture some profit. Bring up the term crack up boom, and I would look up that term if you've not heard it before. A crack up boom, that's what I believe is going on in the stock market right now, because most of the growth of the price of the stock market has gone to a very few, top five, top 10 stock market contenders, in particular Nvidia, where their focus on AI and microchips are kind of the two convergent technologies that stand in the next few years to be profitable. But, you know, everybody's so desperate for profit in a very rancorous economic environment. They're kind of throwing all their chips at Nvidia, as well as a few of the other big players, mainly tech, things like Tesla, and then, you know, Google, Alphabet, Inc. And really, a crack-up boom is where people are desperate to seek profit in a really bad economic environment. And a very few people pick up this, loose money that everybody's desperate to try and make, speculating. They're willing to take more and more risk, risk on assets, to try and make that profit. And really, the rest of the economy isn't seeing a healthy growth. GDP around the world, around the modern Western world or whatever, is actually stalling, and I would say actually falling in real terms. Obviously, GDP, gross domestic product, can be heavily massaged, let's say, by the powers that be, because it's one statistic that they lean on as a kind of a barometer of their success. Along with the inflation numbers going down, GDP going up, you know, simple, green light, good type economic analysis there. But if we're in a crack up boom scenario, much like happened in the Weimar Republic just before the collapse, you saw a rampant growth of the stock market, prices going higher and higher, because people were seeking somewhere where their money would be, you know, it would hold some of its purchasing power or make some money for them. And then, you know, soon after that, once the collapse occurred, suddenly you had the rampant disintegration of the economy. You had the hyperinflation, which is where inflation kind of tips over into a feedback loop, and basically there's no buoy, or in American buoy. There's no level peg for you to judge prices by. So everything's in a state of flux. And at that point, the currency collapses and collapses until it falls to a base level. You know, somebody introduces a new currency, you start a new world war, whatever it is, some new level equilibrium is found. And I think, I'm not trying to dooms for say a doomsday, but I do think that the dominoes are all in a line for such a collapse. Another, thread to pull into that would be the derivatives market, something most people don't understand. I'm not saying I understand the ins and outs of actual derivatives, but I have been researching, and I do know that derivatives current valuation they're actually all debts, firstly, and their current valuation is 10 times the global GDP. So 10 times the value of everything in the world is derivatives, and these derivatives are very prone to collapsing. That's what collapsed in 2008. 2007, 2008, on a much smaller scale than exists today. Those derivatives weren't ever regulated. They weren't ever curtailed. In fact, they were encouraged and have grown to a humongous, gargantuan level, which, completely tips the economy upside down. Any value proposition is kind of distorted, and so all of these things are kind of ghosts, or they're lurking in the background, these specters, and yet if any one of them comes to the fore, or if any one of them were to make headlines and come into the public consciousness, suddenly there would be a run on the banks, there would be demands from politicians and so on and so forth. So I think, as you mentioned, war, particularly the war in the Middle East, which is a theatre, the theatre of war. But I believe right now, having listened to lots of your analysis too, of the current goings on too, that both sides of the Iran-Israel are being played, both sides of Russia-Ukraine are being played in a theatrical sense, in this kind of Cold War type period, whilst this theft is going on in the background. I think it's on a scale that people wouldn't believe, yet if you dig deeper, you can find all of these games being played out in the public. You've mentioned lots of black swans there. The black swan theory is that there is an event, kind of like the butterfly effect. One event is unforeseeable and causes unforeseen consequences, and an event like an oil embargo, or maybe the Houthis in the Red Sea do a certain block a certain ship, and that causes or the Baltimore Bridge collapse. Each of those are kind of referred to as black swans, because those could be events that have an outsized impact on the future, particularly in economics terms.
Well, look, the big one, of course, is the dollar valuation, Blake. That's the kind of backstop for the United States. And interest mm-hmm. rates are one of the big tools that the central banks have to rein in inflation and sort of get the markets, get the money markets and everything under control. But I remember in my lifetime, 12% mortgages. Mm-hmm. That wasn't unusual at the end of the 80s, early 90s, even higher in some cases, 16%. People still bought property then, Blake. Yeah. They still invested. So it was a means to an end in terms of achieving stability. I mean, it might not be popular, whoever's president or whoever's in charge of any central bank or country at that time. But is it a possibility we might see some of those shock therapy to the economy? Because right now we're looking at, we're at $5 a gallon already. Once again in America, and the mm-hmm. price of gas is heading up going into the summer. This is not a good look.
No, and the price of gasoline in America is kind of one of those, as I mentioned, barometers for sort of the success of the political class, so to speak. And, whoever's in power, if the price is good, they've done a good job. Not that they can really control it. It's kind of a big game of chess. In a game of chess, the odds of winning can be measured, but whether you win or not is not guaranteed by any move that you make on the board. And so keeping the sacred $5 keeping it $4.99 or lower is kind of one of the main goals. And Biden's administration has been using as many tools as it has, including plea bargaining with the Saudis, as well as depleting the strategic oil reserve, dumping as much oil as possible, deregulating oil industry in the US as much as it is kind of feasible within the climate hysteria kind of framework to keep the price of oil down. And, you know, that could be an elastic force, which once it breaks, then the price of oil could rampantly go very quickly. Once it breaks, say, a $5.50 limit, it could easily break up to $5, $7, $8, $9, $10. I mean, there's no stopping it. And as a measure of the strength of the dollar, if the dollar weakens, suddenly that price of oil also kind of balances it on the other side of the seesaw into an upwards direction. And people will find, like I said earlier, their wages aren't going up, but the price of gasoline, the price of food goods and other energy sources is going up too. But what you mentioned first was in the 1980s, the interest rates were about 12%, you know, at points, and people were buying properties. I read a really interesting in-depth piece about this, because interest rates are 12%. If now they're at something like 5%, then that's extremely painful. What's going on, and why can't people my age buy houses or get on the property ladder with a job, a decent job? And I can tell you, out of my friendship group, you know, of people born in the 90s, very few have any dreams of getting a house. One person I do know bought a fixer-upper in Aberdeen with his partner and put everything into that. But that's one out of many. And there's not a great optimism that anybody will ever, without outside help, get a property or get on the property ladder. Whereas in the 80s, it was kind of, you know, that era, Thatcher slash Reagan, owning property was a right. It was a, you know, a possibility. And so why did it work with 12% interest rates? Well, 12% was a lot smaller of an amount when your wages were much higher in proportion. It, in fact, since the 1980s, the proportion of your wage that it would cost to buy a house, it would be about 2 to 5 years of your annual wage to buy the house outright. Now, that's 50 years and upwards of your annual wage. So, you know, it would actually take 2 to 5 of your whole pay packet for 2 to 5 years to pay the deposit on a house, let alone but outright pay for the house. Because as wages have stagnated and stayed on this steady line, house prices have been speculated upon, and they've been used as yet another of those political barometers of success. And when the generations who bought houses in the 60s, 70s, 80s see their house price constantly increase, they can harvest some of that profit. You can move up to bigger and better houses, you can invest, speculate, rent out rooms, rent out houses, and so on. You know, that's good for them, and it wins votes. We're finally at the end of that gambit, and there's no more stretch in the elastic of the trousers. Suddenly the gut is spilling over, to use quite an ugly metaphor there. Interest rates are inelastic because the debt has become so high. Again, back in the 80s, the debt to GDP ratio was well under 100%. You know, in the US, you had a very productive economy still. It hadn't been totally hollowed out by the vultures and by the, you know, moving industry to China and everything. Yet it was starting along that path. But now that debt is so high, interest rates multiply with debt, and with debt at like extremely high levels, those interest rates are untenable. I would say that even the kind of the golden chalice of central bank interest rates, which is 2%, is untenable. 2% of like 30 trillion is still a lot of money, and there's no productivity in the modern Western economies to keep up with that. So as much as the central banks like the Federal Reserve keep talking about they're going to do rate cuts, they can't afford to do that. As much as they want to raise the interest rates to cool off the economy or whatever, they can't do that either. They're between a rock and a hard place. And I think people are losing faith in the Federal Reserve and central banks' ability to do anything about rampant price inflation. And it takes a ginormous amount of propaganda to keep these economic malfeasances in the dark. And so hopefully what we're doing here is shining a little light onto those vampire industries of high finance. And, you know, now that we're back on the airwaves, we're going to be doing that on a more regular basis. And there's all sorts coming down the pipeline. And whilst we're keeping one eye on the Middle East and on, the current affairs that, take up the kind of moral Casus Belli, we're keeping another eye on what's bubbling away in the background, festering, because that could suddenly come to the fore, and we want to be ready to ride that wave.
100%, I say 110%, Blake, I'm with you. 110%. That's the debt to GDP ratio for the United States. 110%. 100% for Britain, and 140 for Italy, 214 for Japan. Maybe we're all heading to that Japanese nirvana up there above 200% debt to GDP ratio, a total disaster economically. I hope not. I hope some conservative fiscal policies come in and sanity returns to the fore. I don't know. I'm not holding my breath at the moment, but Blake Lovewell, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
We'll see you again soon.
Great to see you, Blake. Thank you, Basil Way. Top of the hour news headlines coming up. We're going to break in a moment. Scott Ritter on the other side. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I hope you are too. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Stay there.